This is writer and game designer Robin D. Laws.
And this is game designer and writer Kenneth Height.
And this is our podcast, Ken and Robin Talk About Stuff.
Bandwidth brought to you by Pelgrane Press.
Stuff we're here to talk about in this episode include...
The RPG Developer Syllabus.
Forensic Pseudoscience.
The Wastrel.
And Gordon Michael Scallion.
I'm Ken.
And I'm Robin.
And we're talking about stuff. Specifically, Robin, we're talking about a phenomenon that occurs every January. No, not the sudden surge in gym memberships that vanishes by the Ides of March, but something far more transformative for the tabletop landscape.
You mean New Game Master Month, Ken, the time when we take the uninitiated, those who've spent their lives safely on the player's side of the screen, and gently push them into the glorious yet terrifying spotlight of the Game Master's chair.
It's a transition more profound than any alchemical transmutation. And this year, for those who want their first foray into GMing to be as approachable as a warm sunbeam, Magical Kitties Save the Day is a featured game.
It's the perfect starting point for new GMs. While you and I can spend hours debating the occult significance of 19th century Parisian sewers, some people just want to play a really cute kitty who can throw fireballs.
And let's be honest, Robin, compared to some of the eldritch horrors we've summoned in the consulting occultist hut, a hyper-intelligent raccoon is a refreshingly manageable antagonist.
Exactly. If you've been pausing...
Oh no, here we go.
If you've been pausing before taking the leap, New Game Master Month provides a free step-by-step seminar starting in January at newgamemastermonth.com. It's a series of twice-weekly posts that guide you through every moment of preparation.
You get expert advice, a supportive community, and an easy entry game designed to be run by those who find a 400-page rule book a bit
hysterical.
I was not going to say that. No.
By February, you'll be an actual GM. It really is the cat's pajamas of intro workshops. So don't let your New Year's resolutions be a tale of woe.
Go to newgamemastermonth.com to sign up for the totally free seminar.
And remember, in the world of Magical Kitties Save the Day, the only thing more powerful than your magic is your personality.
I'm ending the segment now, Robin.
Fair, I think I used up my 9 lives on that last one.
The rattle of dice, the thump of miniatures, the crunch of Doritos, and the benevolent gaze of Peter Frampton coming alive welcome us once more into the gaming hut. Whoa, look at this. The miniatures have been thumped into their little box. The dice are clattering as we clatter them into their Crown Royal bag, because here we've got books. We've got game books, of course, but also notebooks. Robin, are we back in school? Did we misread the calendar? What is going on in the gaming hut today?
Right. Well, we're back in school, but I guess as instructors, or perhaps even better, as people designing the course for other people to instruct.
It's the best kind of in school.
Yeah. What we talked about earlier was a syllabus for an introductory RPG design course. And that's starting to be taught sort of in various places. But what I'm pretty sure is not being taught anywhere yet is the other side of that creative team, the RPG editor or developer. That's a skill that you only learn by doing it. And there's very little communication between different people who do it. You sort of have to watch what other people are doing and kind of figure it out. But we've both done it, Ken. So if we were hired by an institute of higher learning to teach an RPG editing and development course, what would we put on the curriculum? What topics would we address?
Yeah, it would have to be topics because, as you say, not only is there no body of knowledge that is passed down to newbie game developers, there is not even, you know, a body of knowledge assembled anywhere. There's no books on it. It's very much learned by doing, and maybe if you're lucky, learned by having watched, you know, Lynn Willis or Sean Punch or some other really great game developer do it. And it's not made any easier, obviously, by the fact that every game company has their own specific version of how they do it, either within their corporate culture or in a way that makes sense for the basic accounts receivable, accounts payable system, or they have different notions of scheduling. Some game companies have a very hard schedule because stuff has to come out because it's going into the book trade. This was more common back when there was a book trade and other kinds of distribution than no kind. Other game companies are the, it'll be done when it's done, and we're developing it from a perspective that the first draft should be publishable, and we're just trying to, you know, knock off the few little sprues to bring it into existence. So, and then some game companies do very, very heavy redlining. They handhold the writer. Other game companies assume that the writers are fungible and that the developer is the real final author and act in that way. So the whole job doesn't even have a common job description, much less, as I alluded, a body of lore that is passed down.
Right. And sometimes it's done freelance as well. Yeah. You may be on staff, or you may be hired as a freelance developer to work on a particular book, as I think you've done recently, right?
Yeah. I think we've probably both done that.
So again, we're ducking the subject. So the first topic I would address is, I'm going to assume that somewhere else in this fictive post-secondary institution, there's a straight-up editing course, or a bunch of them, or proofreading and so forth. But we still need to cover, you have to have that course, that's a mandatory. But in this context, we have to look at role-playing specific textual issues. So there is a particular set of quirks that role-playing writers have, and particular things that they tend to overuse. So you want to look at trying to train a next generation of people, not just to copy the idiosyncrasies of the role-playing writers who went before them, but to do their own thing and break out of those stylistic mannerisms, or use them only when necessary and not overuse them. And also there's the issues of the specific things that you're trying to convey with text that you're looking, in this case, has the writer successfully written examples that do the job of being an example? And in amongst them, that there'll be other little tips, like when you're editing an example, the chances of there being a mistake in that example because the designer has a superseded rule in the example that they fixed in the main text but didn't fix in the example is very high. That would be gold, I think, to any RPG editor learning that kind of thing.
Yeah, technical writing is the sort of hidden skeleton of RPG writing that we all, you know, come into it, I think, mostly as people who are fans of genre literature or genre narrative in general, movies, comics, TV, whatever. And we think of ourselves, I think a lot of us, as genre creators, which in many cases we are, but also we have to be technical writers, and the technical writing has to be solid. And so there has to be a degree of technical editing that goes along over and above the, you know, is this rule consistent with previous rules in the line, which is its own question, but does it work? Does it explain itself? Is it reproduced in the example correctly? And once the job becomes rules development on your own, as opposed to editing or developing a text that you are given, then that gets into our game design 101 class that we've also talked about. And to what extent, you know, is the developer meant to run ahead of the field with special cases, with things that are only one-offs in this adventure, et cetera, et cetera. If you've got a zero gravity adventure in your F20 game, suddenly you've got to have zero gravity rules, because unless you were doing espergenesis, you probably didn't have them already. And so that's a question. Does this become rules development? And in many cases, especially in a freelance case, the person developing that text may or may not be the line developer of the whole game. And then that's a whole different question.
Right. And so I think what we're specifically talking about here, and that's different from rules design, is looking at someone else's rules design and determining, first of all, does this make sense to me? Can I run this at my own table based on this text? But also, will this actually work? And the next step on top of that is, the rule might function, but will our players like it? Yeah. Do people want this rule, and do they want it to work this way using table sense, which we've talked about recently as well? So if you are editing a work of fiction, you are getting into dramaturgical issues. You're like, does this scene make sense from this character's point of view? Is this a realistically drawn moment, or have you spent too much time on the realism? Those are all go beyond the level of, you know, just is the text accurately conveyed and use proper syntax, but is this going to work and have its intended effect on the audience, and what is its effect on the audience? So your role as a developer, making sure the rules work, is different from the designer coming up with the rules, but it's something that requires an engagement with the game and an ability to play it and ability to imagine it being played, which comes the next step where you empirically find out whether the players like it or not, and that's playtesting. We've talked about how to run playtests on the show previously, so maybe the person teaching this course can dial up those segments in their entirety, but basically, how do you run a playtest? How do you get the documents out to people? What is the best deadline to impose? How do you interpret the playtest results when they get in? That's an enormous part of it. How do you make sure you prevent playtesters from discussing things with each other and arguing them into things that didn't happen at their table? That's a real combination of logistics, yet creative interpretation on top of that.
Yeah. And then when we talk about interpreting the playtest, a lot of that is, to what extent does that go back to the original writer or designer? To what extent is that your job as developer? Again, that's going to vary company by company and line by line. And likewise, you want to make sure that what results is recognizably an adventure for that game, or recognizably a supplement for that game, unless it is, you know, everyone's signed off on this will be a radical departure. This is the zero gravity F20 adventure. Then you want to make sure that at the end of the day, it might be a good book. It might be a book that people will play at the table, but it might not be a book that belongs in the line of the game you're doing. It might not be a vampire book or a Savage Worlds book, or it might not be a Trail of Cthulhu book or whatever, because it isn't what the line is about. There's no point in having a really, really great cyberpunk supplement for a medieval game. It's just not going to fly with an audience.
Right. And the difference is never that stark, because
right,
if someone proposes to you, I'm going to do the cyberpunk scenario for 13th Age, you might go, and how is that going to be 13th Age-y? And maybe they would explain it and they would get it going. But very often, or you know, it's a classic conflict for a freelancer to go, well, here's my version of how I would like to play this game. And sometimes it's like, actually, we want something that's like how our players play this game. Mm-hmm. And so your job is to, you know, understand what the core elements of the game are, including tone and mood and not just genre, but subgenre. And sometimes you will find yourself either asking the writer to go back to the core elements of the line, and sometimes you will be editing it back into a consistency.
Yeah. And some of that is going to come from the style guide. And the style guide is not just, do we use the Oxford comma, but it's also, and which of our weird nouns and verbs do we capitalize this time? But it's going to be things like, you know, do we give alternating he and she? Do we say they? Do we do some other thing? How do we refer to elves? You know, do we never have elves have eye color or whatever sort of elements of the story or the world that need to be reflected consistently? So a lot of times the style guide will just be a list of, you know, don't do thises. And sometimes it'll be a more general, almost a setting Bible type document that says, this is a game of horror. Player characters should be, their agency should constantly be threatened. It doesn't matter if there's horrible traumatic things under the basement, because that's the point of the game. We have to explain that. Then you also have to have a style guide that says, how do we convey that to the new user of the game? What counts as a disclaimer or other text that you need? And these sorts of things are all being folded into brand consistency. But it might be your job as the editor developer when you say, so what's your style guide? And they say, oh, that would be great. Why don't you write one? And then you have to know how to do that. And I would say developing a style guide by inference from an existing game line would actually be a pretty good academic exercise.
That's probably several weeks of this course. And you're right to sort of suggest by omission that in a lot of cases, the style guide is in the head of the line developer or the original designer. And therefore, that's a challenge for freelancers to hit a series of marks that are sort of implicit in the books. And you can help them by making those explicit. And those of us who are learning by doing this, you know, do that one encounter at a time where you get something in from a writer and go, oh, I should have said that the tone should be X instead of Y, or I should have mentioned that characters in a scenario will always try to break in and steal documents. You should account for that. And in practice, you wind up writing your style guide sort of
piece by
an
piece.
Incident at a time.
Yeah.
And so it would be, if this was a big enough job that it was worth training people en masse to do it, that would be a big part of this imaginary textbook for that. Another thing that you'd be asked to look at is line balance. Is you've got a core book, you've got a bunch of supplements and source books that you want to do. Which ones should you do? Which different types of source books are there? This will vary from line to line. Certain games, the adventures sell well. For example, Mysteries is a case where adventures do sell well. Sometimes other games, if adventures are easy enough to generate on their own, for example, with D20 games or F20 games, those are a harder sell a lot of the time, and you have to do something special, like make it a mega dungeon in order to get people to buy it. But so the question of, when do I drop the bestiary? Should I have a city book? How should I space them out in an ideal world? So that, I think, is a topic for at least 1 week of this course.
And then some of this is just basic business management stuff, which they're probably not getting because they're not business majors, but it's things like dealing with other creatives, contracts, enforcing deadlines, project management in general, all of the stuff where you are the interface between the game company and the creator. If the creator's not on staff, and even if they are, actually, that can even be worse, is you still have to get a manuscript out of them by date certain and then get them to not be mad at you when you've done all the other editing that we've just talked about and changes, so that you can work productively with them, not just on that book, but on the next, you know, two or three books down the line. And it's just a matter of very, very basic stuff that a lot of people learn, you know, in a, like an advertising agency, I assume you learn that almost instantly on the job. But again, the people who go into game design, by and large, are not people who come from the advertising agency world or any other area where sound business communication is prioritized. Let me just say that.
Right. Well, there's two things. There's that paperwork side of things, like issuing contracts and setting up a schedule and staying in touch with people and making sure that the production schedule is, you know, all in a line. And this is what I am learning by doing now. And so in theory, that's all straightforward, except you need to learn it. But the other part of that, the talent relations, the diplomacy of interacting with creative people and getting what you want and need from them while keeping them on board so that if you want to work with them again, they're happy to do that, is the most challenging part of the job. It's, you know, diplomacy with creative people who have their own ways of thinking and their own goals and schedules is something that is very difficult to teach, just as it's very difficult to do. And of all these things, is the thing that you're going to have to accept that it's just going to go wrong a certain number of times. And, you know, developing a style where people are happy to receive notes from you and act on them is a super gigantic challenge that this beginning course will only, I guess, probably alert you to the issues around.
Right. We'll be having lots of recommended courses that you should be taking in communications rather than here in game design.
So I think we've done a pretty good job of laying that course out. I will be gobsmacked if such a thing exists, but I think it's a fun way, anyway, of looking at the various elements of this behind-the-scene job in role-playing that maybe some, definitely some listeners are currently doing or have done.
Right.
And maybe some of you may do in the future. And on that note, I think it's time for us to leave an apple on the desk for teacher and head out to see what other hut and or segment waits for us on the other side.
moving drama.
Hilarious comedy.
And you are the sole protagonist.
Page Turners is my game of personal storytelling for one player and one GM.
Coming in February from Pelgrane Press.
Longtime listeners know Hillfolk, my game of dramatic group play.
Winner of the coveted Diana Jones Award.
Page-Turner shifts its dynamic down to the intimate scale of a single main character whose fiction you weave on the fly with one other creator.
Shockingly simple rules keep the focus on emotional interaction.
Extensive guidance helps you shape satisfying outcomes.
Writers Sarah Sam Saltiel, Wade Rocket, and Ruth Tillman join Robin in presenting 11 scenarios spanning a wealth of genres and tones.
Scenarios include
Jazz Age Ambition and Glamour,
A Childhood Haunted by Strife and a Shadowy Being,
Deceit and Survival on the Spaceship Earth Again,
A Stay in Bath takes an unexpected turn in the Austin-inspired Entreaty and Entanglement,
The Screwball 30s Hijinks of Loose Screws,
The Shakespearean Comedy of Love's Loyal Laborers,
A Love Triangle Unfolding from the Turbulent 60s to the Troubled 20-teens,
Behind the Music Drama in the L.A. Punk Scene,
The Arrival of a Telepathic Stranger on a Spacebound Way Station,
Tragic Love Between a Vampire and a Mortal,
and an epic multi-generational saga of artificial beings attempting to build a civilization in the tradition of that extinct species, Homo sapiens.
Gorgeously laid out and illustrated by graphic superstar Jen McCleary.
Whoever you want to be, wherever your imagination takes you.
Whether your journey leads to Union Doom or something harder to define.
Page Turners unleashes your story in new and unexpected ways.
The mugshots on the wall, the smears on the door from the fingerprints, the filing cabinets full of moldering profiles of past offenders tell us we're once more looking at the crime blotter. This is our true crime segment, and I thought I would look at an issue that's really fascinating and is even bigger now that I've seen your research than I initially envisioned, which is that a lot of so-called forensic sciences are, some of them are outright pseudoscience, but the majority of them just aren't sufficiently proven using the scientific method and are therefore less reliable than they are presented as being and often used to convict people and send them to prison or in some jurisdictions get them sentenced to death. And so I thought this time around we'll go through the various forensic techniques and see which of them are actually reliable and which of them are not. And can, like I said, turns out to be a longer list than I anticipated.
Yeah, when you suggested it, this very much reminded me of our episode on nutrition science in episode 546, where you said, let's look at that ice cream study, and then woke up, I presume, on Tuesday morning to see the detailed devastation of nutritional science that we actually did.
Yes, you weren't so much rejecting the premise as introducing a whole new, wider meta-premise.
Right. Well, this was the premise, but the number of things wrong with forensics was, as you say, bigger than I think either of us knew. The core document that I relied on for a lot of this is something that is very optimistically titled Strengthening Forensic Science in the United States, A Path Forward. This is from the National Academy of Sciences. The report came out in 2009.
Right. Well, the working title was Holy Mackerel, This is a Mess.
Yes. And I'm sure that you're, having experienced the government's great efficiency in every other respect, you're sure that having identified a problem in 2009, we must have fixed it. Well, we haven't. The basic problem for almost all of these methods that you see on CSI and being hypnotized by CSI, the show, is a big cause of this. It happens both on juries. It happens in police departments. It happens in prosecutors' offices. It even happens in defenders' offices, who really should know better. But being hypnotized by CSI, the show, gets you where we are today. And where we are today is that many, many, many of these methods is that they aren't methods. We don't have a standard methodology. There is no list of criteria that you check off. There are also no reporting requirements. You don't have to maintain a chain of mental evidence as you do the analysis. It's a black box. It goes in, the analyst says match, not match, comes out the other side. There is no requirement for any intermediate steps, which is kind of terrifying.
Right. And several of them are just thunk up by people representing themselves as experts who say they did a bunch of experiments, but were very much self-appointed, self-declared scientists.
Yeah. And you mentioned in the first line of this is polygraphs, as everyone knows. And I thought, just to save time, we would take that as read, that everyone knows yes. that polygraphs are pseudoscience. If people want a lie detector episode, we will happily go into it, not least because we can name check Wonder Woman again. But by and large, polygraphs were pseudoscience when they were invented in the 30s and 40s. They have never not been pseudoscience. There are numerous ways to beat them that are known to everyone from psychologists to shoplifters. It's not a thing. Just move past it. That's what I would say about polygraphs.
But speaking of a guy who just made up a bunch of stuff, bite marks.
Yeah. This is a thing that NAS report says there is no science involved at all. The basic problem with bite mark analysis is that when you are bitten by someone who is biting you, you move around, and often the person biting you moves around. Thus, every bite mark is crazily distorted. It's not like you're biting into dental wax to, you know, make your new fake tooth. This is, you're biting something that is moving around, and you are moving around. Skin, I don't know how many people have touched their own skin, but I recommend it. It's lovely. It's elastic. It pushes. It does not stay stiff like wax or clay. So therefore, bite marks change shape over time. And if you are on the scene after the biter has departed, then you are definitionally too late to get a good bite mark. There are no points in bite marks. Fingerprints have a series of points. Each finger is given, I think it's like 20 points. It might even be more now with computers, but it used to be 20 in the old days. And where those would coincide, that would be your points of comparison. That doesn't even exist for bite marks. So there's no way to establish or refute a correlation. It is entirely based on the intuition of the expert. And in 2016, to put the cherry on top, the President's Council of Scientific Advisors report said that bite mark analysis can't even reliably determine if a bite mark is human, which actually shocked me. I really thought we could at least at this late stage tell a person's teeth from a monkey's teeth, but apparently we can't even do that.
Right. And once again, lots of people have been convicted on bite mark evidence.
Oh, yes. Yes. For every one of these cases, again, you can, with very little trouble, find a absolutely specific case where this is the only evidence that sent someone to a very lengthy prison sentence at the very least. So, yeah, again, trying to keep this down to one segment instead of a whole episode, I did not put those into these reports, but assume that there is some travesty of justice attached to all of these. So, from bite marks, we move to hair analysis, which even the FBI did an audit that said that in 96% of the 3,000 cases studied, the expert had given an assessment materially overstating the match. I'm not sure what that means for a yes-no assessment, but I'm sure it's not good. It's been known to be bogus since 1984. An earlier study said there was zero evidence that hairs are individual, not counting the DNA, but the FBI still uses it because the FBI is going to FBI.
Next, we come to fiber analysis, which is at least a little bit better.
Yeah, because the fibers that you're analyzing are analyzed with a real science, namely chemistry. It's not an interpretive observation. So depending on the fiber, you can, in theory, match a specific fiber to another specific fiber chemically. What you can't do is match it by observation for all the reasons we've just discussed. And almost always, and this is just an empirical study of the data, fiber analysis can only determine the class evidence. This comes from polyester, not the specific type evidence. This comes from a blazer made in China in 2022. And again, almost never ever, this comes from that guy's blazer. The best you can say is both blazers are polyester. They have the same dye lot, et cetera, et cetera. But again, in a world where individual couture has gone the way of the dinosaur, this is not criminally, or should not be criminally, allowable testimony.
And if we're going to look at the ratio of most people locked up for the least science, we come to blood spatter.
Yeah, and this is the one, as you were alluding, Robin, this is one of those where a guy just made it up. He was a analytical chemist named Herbert McDonald. He got fascinated by blood spatter because he was, you know, sort of a guy who was called in to do chemical work on crime scenes. And he said, well, there has to be a way to study, you know, where the blood spatter went, what produced it. He's not a fluid dynamic physicist, which would be the actual field that would study blood spatter. He trained a bunch of cops and gave them all certificates as blood spatter analysts, and then said, go and train other cops in my methods and pay me $40 or whatever for my textbook, and has basically single-handedly seeded his blood spatter experts throughout America from his basement in, you know, I think upstate New York somewhere. And he is now retired. There's a scandal attached to his name that is not even about this. But fundamentally, leaving that aside, it isn't science. 2009, that same report said there's no scientific research into it, much less scientific methodology. There's no science behind it. This is just a guy's intuitive guessing. A fluid dynamicist did get interested after this report dropped and got millions and millions of dollars from the Department of Justice to study blood spatter. And then when he presented his results, the Department of Justice, to their credit, said, you've just shown that you can determine blood spattered onto flat cloth. That's not any use in the field. Go away. And so now he's setting up his own version of the blood spatter clinic and charging sheriff's departments and other people to do his pretend science. So he basically got co-opted by the field that he was studying, as we have discussed with our nutrition episode, happens a lot.
Right. Especially here where there's a powerful incentive for law enforcement to get convictions. So there's a not only incentive to be an expert witness, but to be an expert witness who will say the things that the prosecutors and police want them to say.
Right.
But fingerprints, can they go all the way back to the Belle Epoque? They've got to be absolutely tried and tested, right?
Well, they are tried and tested. And then people do not often ask, so what did the test show? As far as we know scientifically, fingerprints are unique. That does seem to be genetically determined. It does seem to be a thing. There has not been a reliable report that I've found of two people with the same fingerprints. But fingerprint interpretation, the method is called ACEV, is entirely subjective, like all of these other things. One 1995 test gave a 34% error rate in fingerprint testing. The 2008 study said that ACEV has no scientific basis. FBI in 2011 tested 169 experienced print examiners. They tested them on 744 pairs of fingerprints, of which 520 contained true matches. 85% of the examiners missed at least one of the matches. The examiners also came back 7 months later and they gave them 25 of the same fingerprint pairs that they had seen earlier, and they changed their conclusions in 10% of the cases. So these are trained, selected by the FBI. This is goosing the study as hard on the positive side as you possibly can goose a study, and they still have between a 10 and 85% failure rate. And this does not even get into latent fingerprints, which is a whole different question, or palm prints or any of these other things. The whole world of what they call friction ridge analysis to get your palm prints and footprints in there is all that bad. And this is even before you get into corruption or errors in fingerprint databases, which is also a thing that happens because they're as vulnerable as every other large database. I pause for you to think of the words two-factor authentication or there has been a password breach.
So the big issue here is pattern matching, right? If you have a science where the determining point is a person making a judgment, is it a science? How reliable is it? And so that gets us to a whole bunch of other things, including stuff that I have always assumed to be reliable, including ballistics. That's straight out of like the Hardy Boys and Dick Tracy comics. That's always been a thing. That has to be entirely reliable, right?
Well, it's exactly as reliable as fingerprints because it also is determined entirely by the examiner. And there's never been any scientific evidence that every gun has its own ballistic fingerprint. This seems to have just been, you know, like Freud saying, well, steam engines work. The brain must be a steam engine. This is someone saying fingerprints work. Guns must have fingerprints. They're so wonderful and individual. This despite the fact that guns are, of course, mass-produced in giant factories.
It's so counterintuitive, I thought it had to be accurate, but no, it's just counter-correct.
It's just nonsense. A 2020 test at the University of Iowa called the Ames-2 test demonstrated that the same ballistics experts, the same examiners, found the same match on the same bullets 65% of the time. That means minimum a 35% error rate. And that's with, you know, again, very carefully selected experts. This is not with just Joe random guy at the lab in, you know, South Carolina or wherever. There is even less scientific backing for ballistics as there is for fingerprints. And it has all the other problems of interpretation that we've talked about.
Right. Other pattern matching methods that have exactly the same problem, footwear analysis or footprint impressions or taking casts of footprints. The follow-up study, the 2016 Presidential Council of Advisors on Science and Technology study that you mentioned, it holds that footwear analysis, exact same problem. Tire impressions, exact same problems. There's actually been no studies on it. And as with all of these ones we've been mentioning now, it's entirely inconsistent because it's depending on just people, they're eyeballing it, you know, it's called eyeballing for a reason.
Yeah. And we're all familiar with, you know, the Sherlock Holmes, oh, that's a Dunlop tire with a patch. Many times it doesn't have a patch. even Sherlock Holmes gets the story juiced to make him look good, or maybe especially. Handwriting analysis, wildly enough, there's no scientific evidence. It's expert self-identification, but it tests better. In 1997, the test gave only a 7% error rate, and one in 2002 gave only a 4% error rate. So for whatever reason, we're, I guess, hardwired to recognize handwriting better than we are fingerprints, but good for the graphologists. I'm not sure that you want to put a capital case on something with even a 4% error rate, but, you know, it's at least been tested, which is more than a lot of these things have.
Yes. So I guess of the pattern matching ones, for reasons we cannot explain, it does better. Another famous example is shaken baby syndrome, where there are three symptoms when an infant has died that have been used since about the late 60s, early 70s to determine that the baby has basically been shaken to death by an abuser. The problem there is that the original studies have come under serious fire from other scientists who have looked at the biomechanics of this. It doesn't check out. The original study just looks at another unrelated study and just makes a leap from it and takes it as read. And so there's a tenuous connection, but many, many people have been sentenced on the basis of, with no other evidence. Like if there's other evidence of abuse, that's, you know, that's other evidence.
That's other evidence, literally.
A bunch of people. Yeah. But there are a bunch of people who have gone to prison for otherwise inexplicable deaths of infants on this theory. And this is one where we've seen a turnaround on it. In 2023, a New Jersey judge ruled it invalid as evidence because there's so much controversy around it. You know, if something's going to be considered reliable beyond a reasonable doubt, scientists have to agree on it. They don't. And in fact, just now, just today, as we record this, the New Jersey High Court has affirmed 6-1 that shaken baby syndrome evidence is not evidence and cannot be accepted. But there's another 49 states will have to recognize that. And there's, again, people still in jail right now because of that supposed evidence.
And this is true with a lot of these, that various state Supreme Courts have ruled that these are evidence and, you know, or even it's been codified into law. So, you know, make sure that your defense attorney knows which state you're in and try not to commit crimes in states that codify pseudoscience as law. And also don't be a witch.
Right. Or don't commit crimes and don't get unjustly accused. Right.
Yeah. Better all of this, but definitely be aware and feel free to bring it up with any prosecuting attorney that you happen to run across. Anyway, 9/11 call analysis. This is where they take the vocal stress and word choice and everything of someone making a 9/11 call and they figure out if it was actually the murderer. This is just lie detecting without even the electronics. Even the FBI, the most credulous dupes on the planet, in two studies, 2020 and 22, say that it is more likely than not to produce erroneous results. Five separate academic studies have found no scientific evidence for it. So I guess this was one where they said, we got to jump on this one early before, you know, Iowa says that it's constitutionally allowable as evidence or wherever. But yes.
Yeah, that's just sort of a boiled down version of the, was the defendant acting weird?
Yes, exactly.
And that's, you know, that's used to convict people all the time. And often it turns out people who are falsely accused because they were kind of weird. They're neurodivergent. They didn't have the same obvious reactions that cops expected them to have to
right. situations. Or maybe they were in shock because they just stumbled across a murder. Who can say?
Yeah, which is what you would think is the entirely observable, you know, obvious reaction. But if you're trying to convict somebody, you twist that the other way around.
Exactly. The have you stopped beating your wife of evidence collection? The final bit of this is DNA. And DNA is sound. It rests on, as someone said, this is not something that criminalists came up with. This is something that came out of cutting edge science and was adapted by criminalists, which makes it at least more plausible. But as always, trust the science does not mean trust the scientist or trust the expert or trust the lab tech. DNA is incontrovertible proof of identity as long as the chain of evidence is kept, as long as the samples are pure. Washington, D.C.'s DNA lab was deaccredited in 2015 after repeated failure to correct cross-contamination problems in over 182 cases that they admitted. Austin, Texas, in 2016, had to shutter its DNA lab and retest 1,300-plus cases because, again, you have two pieces of DNA on the same, you know, swab or whatever. And sometimes this is the testers, sometimes it's some rando at the scene. Who can say? The tests are also often just contaminated. In 2004, one single FBI tech, a woman named Jacqueline Blake, pled guilty to filing false reports on 100 cases. And this is one tech in the FBI lab, so... And that was just 1 year, and one assumes that the FBI was doing everything they could to minimize their exposure on it. Or sometimes they're just imaginary results. New York City medical examiner developed a proprietary and entirely unproven testing technique for picogram samples of DNA, just trillionth of a gram samples. And it turned out that was nonsense. It was errant nonsense, but they were charging other medical examiner departments around the country $1,200 a pop for the test. So they had a real incentive to do it. Between 2011 and 2016, they bollocksed up 4,000 DNA cases as a result of that. And again, you've got, you know, people who went to prison because of this guy who invented his own software and decided that the way to make money was to sell it to the medical examiner.
Yeah, it's a case of somebody making up something and bolting it on top of an accepted actual
science. Or that it's fringe cutting-edge science, but it's just not actually proven. They had a technique that sounded like it might work, but the time to do the testing is elsewhere, not when, you know, criminal defendants' freedom is dependent on it.
Yes, might work is not beyond a reasonable doubt.
No.
There's sort of a reverse thing that happened. You mentioned CSI, which is that ever since CSI has aired, and I don't know if this has died off now that it's less omnipresent in culture, that juries started exonerating people because there wasn't forensic evidence in a case, and they expected the every case to have the same level of bulletproof evidence that was presented to them on their favorite show, CSI. And so prosecutors became frustrated. It's like, this isn't even a case with physical evidence, and they're throwing it out because there's no, you know, why don't you zoom in on an image and extract the information from the JPEG? There's more than pixels there, right? And so that's sort of an issue. And, you know, even gumshoe games have a bunch of forensic abilities, particularly in the esoterics, that treats all of these things as real and reliable. And it's an interesting question as to, you just basically have to say, well, in this game, which also has screaming demons from the outer dark, we're also going to accept that ballistics works.
You know, and for game purposes, one can accept a lot that I would not accept, you know, on a jury, for example. And I think that's the important lesson that we've learned, is that don't take a human life based on something you read in a game or saw on CSI, even if the FBI is nodding along and agreeing with you, or maybe even especially.
Yes, almost like they have an incentive to do that. Well, on that note, it's time for us to head into another, perhaps more salubrious hunt. In the spiral,
four scenarios embrace the works and deaths of agents between 2016 and 2020, years called the Spiral and the Delta Green Campaign, God's Teeth.
That span of cruelty and corruption in American government seemed a bitter interregnum.
A momentary eruption of spite.
Now it stands revealed as a preparation for revelations to come.
In God's eye, a baffling disappearance leads the agents to confront the inexorable government panopticon.
They face unnatural revelations unleashed by the death of privacy.
And must survive desperate revenge beneath the sleepless skies.
In God's breath, a Delta Green friendly leaves a frantic voicemail about a Denver prisoner vomiting up an alien worm.
Your agents must identify the unnatural threat.
Trace it to its source.
Burn it out.
Just be careful of the smoke.
In God's law, a shockingly gruesome death leads the agents to a Los Angeles police gang.
It has twisted older, deeper laws towards the tired avarice of corruption.
How far do the agents go to resist the unnatural?
In God's light, the wreckage left by a mass shooter catches Delta Green's attention.
Somehow behind it, a surprising app that reaches strange places on the border between worlds.
The scenarios of God's Hunt are playable with Arc Dream Publishing's Delta Green, the role-playing game.
Play the scenarios on their own, as a cycle, or as a perfect companion to the acclaimed campaign Delta Green, God's Teeth.
Learn more about Delta Green at delta-green.com.
Keep this podcast's martini dry by joining such beloved Patreon backers as
Ryan McClelland,
Tone Milazzo,
Tony Kemp,
Alex Johnston,
and David Mesgari.
Punch Hit and Judy, the comedy mask and the drama mask, the pile of hats in the closet that briefly tempt us into another hut, but we're sticking in this one, tell us that we are backstage at the stock character hut where they are getting ready to be made up for their endless round of performances. And this stock character will be the wastrel. And for this, Robin, why don't you give us a brief pressy on the wastrel to exclude, as you wish, the spiraling alcoholic, and also, I would say, to exclude the black sheep, which is kind of a different character as well. What are we looking at?
Right. So the wastrel is bibulous, is probably a drinker or a user of drugs or both, is a hedonist, is a bohemian, and has worn away at the edges, may also be a rake, is a roisterer, and is wasting their life away, but is often presented charmingly. So I wanted to leave out the spiraling alcoholic because that is the protagonist of another sort of story. The wastrel, I think, is a stock character who might pop up in your page-turner scenario. For example, there's one who may be your confidant in The Beacon named Abbott Conant. We talked about him earlier when we ran through the list of supporting characters for that. So this might be your sort of charmingly louche character, or they might have a bit of a sinister cast to them, but they're not the character in a tragedy. In the most favorable version of that, they're sort of the charming drunk. A black sheep, which is a member of a family in a family drama who is the source of problems for that family or is the odd person out, might indeed be a wastrel. They might be the black sheep because of their overindulgence in celebratory substances, but that's not necessarily the case, right? They may be the hothead, as in Sonny in The Godfather, or the Luke Wilson character in Tenenbaums is the black sheep just because he's profoundly depressed, right? And so there's overlap, but it's not the exact same character. And there's lots of wastrels who they're not the figure in a family drama. So
right.
You might be both, but they're not exactly the same thing.
Okay.
So often we go to Shakespeare. And so Prince Hal and Falstaff, and also in Twelfth Night, Toby Belch and Andrew Aguecheek, I think, are the most obvious examples of the wastrel character. And with Prince Hal and Falstaff, of course, there's the famous turn where Hal must turn his back on Falstaff and turn his back on being a wastrel. And that's sort of the big transformation. Whereas Belch and Aguecheek just remain the sort of louche comic figures who provide conflict and fun. But we do not expect them to reform. And in fact, we'd be somewhat sad if they did.
Yeah, the Prince Hal is, I think, one of our classic models of this. And when I did a little bit of research, I was surprised that there doesn't seem to have been an awful lot of, I guess, what the Bible would call the prodigal son as a protagonist or even, you know, main supporting characters in Greek tragedy or even in the, you know, Roman plays afterwards, the Commedia dell'arte. It doesn't really seem to have come up, which is wild given how many wastrels any given playwright must have met. So it's wild that Prince Hal and Falstaff are kind of our type examples, but they are.
Well, and it may be that, especially in Roman culture, wildly overindulging in hedonism was just like,
it's just a Tuesday. So, yeah.
How's that a conflict?
That's right.
Core to our culture. So you get the sort of bachelors who are ineligible due to their worldliness and bad behavior in Austin. So you get George Wickham in Pride and Prejudice, Tom Bertram in Mansfield Park, often described as a wastrel. So that was like a obvious type of person in the Regency era who you had to look out for. And in that same century, a real life example, who is then the model for many other fictional characters, of course, is Lord Byron, who in the famous phrase is mad, bad, and dangerous to know. He has that romantic aura of attractive dangerousness in addition to his destructive hedonism.
And he also has genuine skill and ability, which is something that is not always connected to the wastrel, although again, with Prince Hal, it clearly is. So, you know, that's an interesting twist on the wastrel, is that, you know, whenever Lord Byron found himself too deep in debt, he would just write another poem cycle and clever his way back out of it.
Yeah. We're going to hit some other surprisingly skilled wastrels since we go along our list here.
And then my sort of best example of the most charming wastrel is Bertie Wooster. And I guess the question is, Bertie is definitely, he's a member of a club of guys that gonna get drunk and fight cops. They screw around and don't accomplish anything. They're a horrible disappointment to their aunts. Are they basically too nice to be wastrels, or are they just the best possible light on the wastrel, Bertie Wooster?
I think the second. I think that his drinking is secondary in Woodhouse to his being a nitwit. That it's part of his, you know, satire of upper class fools. And he's definitely that. He's a hedonist who gets into trouble because of that. And he gets into trouble for all sorts of reasons, you know, his propensity for proposing to women after initially meeting them and all sorts of things. And that's part of the comic. You know, he is the chaos, whereas Jeeves is the order. So that, I think that definitely fits there. And also, the most efficient wastrels of all are Nick and Nora Charles from Dashiell Hammett and from the series of movies with William Powell and Myrna Loy. They are skilled detectives, as well as, at least in the book and in the early films, prodigious drinkers and consumers of alcohol. And that's just all a hilarious joke and a shtick, and doesn't impede their ability to solve murders at all.
And of course, the funny joke of that is that Nick, at least, wants to be a wastrel. He's trying to be a wastrel. He's like the opposite of Prince Hal. He used to be a super competent detective. Now he just wants to be a wastrel, but he keeps being prevented from wasting his life by all this crime happening near him. And that's another fun take on the wastrel, is the guy who's trying to work very hard at wastreling, but, you know, they keep pulling him back in, like Lord Byron's muse. Another example of the wastrel is the person who may or may not be wasting their life from their own perspective, and I think even Bertie in his moments might recognize that he's not accomplishing anything. Dickie Greenleaf in Ripley, he thinks he's an artist. He's out there arting in Italy. Everyone who knows him or even encounters him basically says, no, he's a wastrel. He's just spending his dad's money and accomplishing nothing. So you have the sort of overlap with the sensitive artist. And of course, because Patricia Highsmith had no more time for sensitive artists than she had for anyone else, Dickie Greenleaf is etched in acid, even as he is set up to be murdered by the talented Mr. Ripley.
Another couple of real life people who, instead of being fictionalized by others, fictionalized themselves, Hunter S. Thompson and Charles Bukowski, who both embody the sort of rebel anti-hero counterculture consumer of drink in the case of Bukowski, and drink and drugs in the case of Hunter S. Thompson, who, you know, described the fictional Hunter S. Thompson character in his quasi-journalistic novels as consuming a quantity of drugs that would have killed him 20 times over. But that is sort of, getting closer to your rock star wastrel, right? And there's all, you know, then you get into other real life characters and the fictional characters who are modeled on them, like right. Keith Moon or other sort of figures of excess. And we know what happened to Keith Moon. That's often a tragic, dark thing, but this is the romanticized, self-glamorized version of the wastrel.
And a lot of it is the sort of the modern, or at least mid-century version of Byron, that again, where prodigious druggies and alcoholics, just like Byron, but also just like Byron, were super talented writers, and therefore maybe the world owes us a living, or maybe we can wrest our living from the world despite our impairment.
Speaking of impairment, we get to some classic films, starting with my favorite year, the Alan Swan character, played by Peter O'Toole famously. This is a film about a guest star on a variety show that is closely modeled on Your Show of Shows and the comic chaos that ensues in trying to corral this Errol Flynn-like movie star, brilliantly, hilariously played by Peter O'Toole. So he's an example of the wastrel as an engine of comic energy in the story. And probably one of the last adorable drunks that tries to sort of skate past the idea of how rough alcoholism is Arthur, as played by Dudley Moore in the original film version of Arthur. And there's also a classic Western portrayal that's near and dear to your heart, Ken.
Yeah, Doc Holliday is someone who is not necessarily, you know, crippled or even particularly hampered by the drinking that he does, because he's dying of tuberculosis. And so his wastrelosity comes from the knowledge that he's a dead man walking, and he is simultaneously destroying himself morally by becoming a serial murderer, but also trying to, you know, do that one Byronic gesture in this case, his friendship with Wyatt Earp. And so that flips the wastrel again a bit on its head, where if Falstaff was the most deadly gunman in the West and Wyatt Earp is Prince Hal, and in this case, Falstaff knows that the betrayal will happen. He just knows that it's going to happen thanks to tuberculosis, not thanks to Wyatt having to change himself.
Right. And various millionaire playboy alter egos of superheroes are sort of fake wastrels. They're pretending to be Bertie Wooster when they're really the Scarlet Pimpernel, or you've mentioned particularly the Christian Bale Bruce Wayne in The Dark Knight as an example.
Yes, that is, again, Nolan attempting, and successfully, I would say, to make Bruce Wayne's wastrel behavior both an effective mask and a sort of a road not taken character moment. And then also, because he's Christopher Nolan, all that wastrel behavior also drives plot and creates story beats in the movie. So you can watch Dark Knight as a Bruce Wayne movie almost as successfully as you can a Batman movie, which is one of the many interesting things about that film and about Bale's Bruce Wayne.
So we've been reiterating again and again, whether it's a protagonist or a supporting character, that the wastrel adds chaos to a story and color and energy and a life that is also sometimes paired with self-destruction. And so that motif plus that story energy is the thing that makes that character work. And you can drop one into almost any ensemble cast, whether you're choosing to play one in Drama System or whether you're writing one as a supporting character into a page-turner scenario. Or you could even, you know, do the spiraling alcoholic as the protagonist in a page-turner scenario if you were to create one and find someone who wanted to play that. So this is a stock character we're going to continue to see for those reasons, and that you can make good use of in your own gaming. You might want to decide your next F20 bard has a bit of a drinking problem or is dissipated in other ways. That could be, if you control it and make it not a drag for the other players who have to continue to get you out of trouble, you could, be more Doc Holliday, I guess,
yeah,
than Alan Swan. And on that note, let's see what awaits us on the other side of this exciting commercial. December 5th, 1775. A wagon train led by bookseller-turned-artillery officer Henry Knox arrives at Fort Ticonderoga in upstate New York.
His goal, haul captured British cannons through the snowy mountains to the siege of Boston and drive the redcoats from the cradle of liberty.
This year, Henry Knox's noble train of artillery delivers presents not to General Washington, but to you!
In Flagbearer Games' exciting Revolutionary War role-playing game, Nations and Cannons.
Visit nationsandcannons.com and use promo code CANNON at checkout for 17.75% off and free PDFs of your books. We're going to once more weave our way into that most ill-defined of huts, the hut where there's a guy writing about a crank history in one corner and somebody else is, I see there's a weird map going up. I think that's actually for this segment, but I'm looking out the window. I see the alien big cat screaming on the moor. They're over in the corner. They got mentioned a lot last time we talked about space and UFOs and aliens, so they're going to check out and just drink their kombucha. That's, of course, the Nordic alien and the gray alien. But Ken, we're going to flash back to the secret maps exhibit at the British Library that we talked about recently. And one of the things we discovered there was a big, beautiful, super nutty map by a guy named Gordon Michael Scallion.
Yes.
Which showed what the world would look like after it was severely inundated after a magnetic pole shift. So I've sent you off to get us more information on Gordon Michael Scallion. What'd you find?
First of all, I found, and this is delightful, that virtually every hard fact about him appears on websites that sell maps. These guys, because they have to talk about the provenance of these maps, did a bunch of actual research into Gordon Michael Scallion. I did find a couple of interviews that he did on vastly defunct websites, but good old Wayback Machine pulled them up for me. But yeah, this is one where if it weren't for the good people at davidrumsey.com and a couple of other map selling establishments, I would know very little about this guy. But what I do know,
rescue yourself from obscurity, listeners, make a cool, weird map that other people will have to grapple with.
Yeah, so I do know that he was born in 1942. He had a career as an electronics consultant, apparently was making really good money, according to his own recollection. In 1979, during a client meeting, he loses his voice, just can't speak, goes to the hospital to have himself checked out. They can't find anything, but while he's there, he has what he called a true opening or a psychic awakening, complete with colors and lights and visionary experiences from the Matrix, is where he eventually decided this came from. And this was before the movie, including a woman hovering above him. So that's pretty exciting. And throughout his next couple of years, he has visions. They sort of like overlay his regular sight. They predict the future. They reveal the past. When he's in Asheville, North Carolina, he sees domed cities, and he doesn't know if they're from the future or if they're the Atlantean mines in Asheville. Maybe both. Who can say? This also, these colors and lights give him aura sight. People start approaching him to heal them. There's a lovely anecdote of two strangers who approach and have been sent to him by powers. And anyway, he becomes an aura healer. He establishes something called the Matrix Institute circa 1982. He moves to Chesterfield, New Hampshire in 1984, following the dictates of the inner voice in him. And the Chesterfield is over 300 feet above sea level, which will keep it safe coming from the coming earth changes. In 1985, he says an inner voice said, "We're going to start training." And I asked, "Who are you?" And they said, "This is your monad." And his monad, which is a theosophical term meaning your irreducible soul, would usually manifest around 5 a.m, and it would last about 15 minutes, and that's when he would be trained.
That
and
is start a terrible time for your monad to show
it's
up.
It's awful.
5 a.m. That's gross.
If only I, you know, were up at 5 a.m. I guess I am up at 5 a.m, but it's still a terrible time. Anyway, the monad opens his predictive vision, teaches him how to use it. It's sort of a stereoscopical thing that when he gets a single full color image, he knows that the future has been set. So he predicts the 1984 Mexico City earthquake. He predicts Bush's election win in 1988. I don't know if you needed a monad train you to do that. He predicted Mount Pinatubo erupting and Hurricane Andrew. And by 1991, he has had a series of 29 dreams called the Earth Changes Dreams, in which he visualizes the Earth as one of his own aura patients needing to be healed. This is the sort of super strong Gaia hypothesis. And this sort of sets him off on writing down these dreams in what he calls the Earth Changes Report, and then he starts doing maps to accompany the Earth Changes Report, of which 100,000 of them have been sold by 1995, and the Earth Changes Report in 1994 cost $36 a year, which was good money in 1994. And the Earth Changes Hotline, our younger listeners may not even know such a thing was a way to scam money out of people, but it was. And you would charge 95 cents a minute for the Earth Changes Hotline. You would call and ask, am I going to be flooded when Atlantis comes back? He would release videos. One of them claimed that of the 43 specific events he predicted in 1992, 33 of them happened when and where he said, which actually I kind of like that he's owning that. Almost a quarter of his predictions were bogus. That's good for him.
Yeah, that's slick to say I'm better than random chance,
right.
But I still get things wrong.
Right.
So that's pretty good for
profit. It leaves him open for things like, isn't California supposed to have disintegrated by now? His February 1994 newsletter said that in 1993, he had 53 hits and 13 misses. My favorite of the predictions from that era was a hum phenomena will begin to make vast numbers of people sick with flu-like symptoms in America. The hum phenomena will be caused by tectonic plates rubbing against one another. And so basically, you know, continent-wide Havana syndrome, which I love, and animals will also become erratic thanks to the hum. So he predicted the deadly hum. I don't know that that happened unless we're assuming that everything that has happened this century is a hum of some kind, which might work. He also predicted, as I said, that California will break off and disintegrate after a Richter 10 to 11 earthquake in 1993 or 1995, one of the 90s. So that is not a geological correct prophecy. It is only a metaphysical correct prophecy. Also, they changed the Richter scale, which he didn't predict. He predicted the pole shift between 1998 and 2001. A lot of people were predicting pole shifts, including our buddy Edgar Cayce. Robin, you went and found Edgar Cayce's pole shift for us.
Yeah, so this is the pole shift thing is not original to Scallion. So the much more famous prophet and electronic healer, Edgar Cayce, predicted a pole shift with a similar wave of cataclysms, particularly volcanic in his case. But he foresaw a measly 16 to 20 degree shift of the magnetic pole, whereas Scallion ups the ante to, he starts at 20 and he predicts anywhere up to 45 degree shift. So that's a big deal. Now the poles have shifted at different points in the vast history of the planet, but actual scientists say it was never a huge deal. It was never accompanied by this level of cataclysmic activity.
Yes, there's a very cool thing called the Fulgurite event, which we could talk about in maybe in Fun with Science or maybe in Elliptony, but human civilization was not destroyed in the 8th century BC. So there we are. But there was a lot of pole shift prediction, including 180 degree pole shifts predicted. But Scallion predicted that the pole shift would also move the moon closer to the Earth, which will cause a move towards a more lunar society with more feminine overtones in it because the moon is a girl. And therefore, both men and women will have our intuitive capacity increased by the moon, which will help lead humanity to be reborn in unity and harmony by 2002, which will help because Atlantis and Lemuria will resurface during all these earthquakes and flood out a big chunk of the rest of the country. The United States, sadly, being flooded out, as you can see by the cool maps, will be replaced by a confederation of 13 colonies, each of them which has meetings at sacred sites to reaffirm the spiritual commitment of the colonies. 75% of the survivors will be children under the age of 15, concentrated in relocation centers in the undrowned states, including, I guess, Vermont and New Hampshire, where they will become the parents of the next root race, which is another nice theosophical shout out. Scallion always denied that he got his woo from other sources. He said, I read them, but those sources don't tell you anything. They have fragments of the truth. Only the Matrix can give you the real truth. Finally, to cap things off, a blue star will arrive at Earth to become our twin sun, and the blue star's rays will turn all humans blue, which I guess will help with that unity and harmony, and it will awaken our psychic powers, including the ability to read the thought form records in the Lemurian City of Gold. And one of the things I like about this guy, over and above his commitment to quality cartography, is there's stuff in there like the hum and the Lemurian City of Gold thought form records that I feel are genuinely additions to the field.
These are great images.
Yeah.
And he is building on a foundation, but the things he's putting on the foundation are pretty cool.
Yeah. The maps, by the way, have enormous captions full of great descriptions. So communities seem to be located in rural areas rather than cities. The area is clean. There is no ozone hole. I see circular clustered homes, domes made of a kind of living membrane. That's gross. There are no automobiles, but there are public transit, giant cigar-shaped airships. Robin, you'll be glad to know. They don't have wheels. Lifespan is up to 150 years. Telepathy all the time, including with animals. That's nice. There's new flowers, plants, and trees, which provide new herbal remedies. Color and sound therapy is how we heal now. And the common spiritual belief is the oneness. And so we've replaced all those dodgy old religions with the new cool religion of oneness. And then the new cycle begins. This is on the future map of the United States, 1998 to 2001, which was printed in first in 92 and was updated in 96. The future map of the world, printed around that same time, may have been reprinted in 2006. The Matrix Institute had a website for a while. It is last active in 2011. It's dead now. And Scallion drops out of the news as late as 2014, his last mention in newspapers. So has Gordon Michael Scallion evanesced? Has he become the Hum or the Harmony or the Oneness? Has he gone to the Blue Star? Is he still kicking around in New Hampshire saying, oh yeah, talk smack now, Chicago. You're going to get drowned come the earth changes. Who can say, but I wish him nothing but the best, because those maps are amazing. And you should absolutely Google Gordon Michael Scallion map and you will have so much joy that you might your own self be able to read a thought form record.
Now, there is someone carrying on in his tradition with something called the I Am America map, which he updates every couple of years in a sort of an atlas format. It's the self-described prophet Lori Toy, who has a current functioning website where you can find her blog and media appearances and sign up for readings or tutelage. The I Am America map, which she describes as coming out of her ascended master tradition, point to the fact that this is related to the I Am activity, which I know we also talked about the I Am movement, but I can't find which episode because the founder, Guy Ballard, called his movement I Am, therefore he has terrible SEO, and I can't search for it and find the episode. But anyway, she doesn't credit Scallion, but she's clearly working a very similar sort of beat, and I'm not sure whether the ultimate outcome of the future her maps predict is as eventually utopian as Scallion's or not. But, you know, there's someone who's picked up that baton and isn't continuing to market books.
Yes. And Scallion, her work overlaps his. And in one of his interviews, he does say he's seen the I Am America map. And he says, well, it's basically the same as my map. We're obviously seeing the same events. It's just that her resolution isn't as good as mine. But he says, if you took all of these maps and laid them out next to each other in a cookie cutter or a cave painting, and which I love that example, then they would clearly be the same map, which way to damn with faint praise, Gordon Michael Scallion. What a great guy, except for the, you know, yes, scam hotline, I guess, but still.
I did find a 2021 Forbes article by the travel writer Jim Dobson, and it starts with Scallion and his maps and the idea of this cataclysm and things being inundated, and then tries to connect it to billionaires. He names Jeff Bezos, Bill Gates, Ted Turner, John Malone, buying vast tracts of inland territory, which presumably will not be inundated. And he really wants you to make the leap to these super rich people are motivated by apocalyptic theory, possibly of Scallion. But unfortunately, the work of proving that is absent from that article. And it's
and also a lot of these guys are also buying like oceanfront property and islands and stuff, which I think.
Right. And also if you want to buy a big tract of land, the interior is where there's big tracts of land that you can buy.
It's where they are. You know, Montana's what's got the big tract of land, not Long Island.
Yeah. But if you're doing a make 'em up, of course, you can have your evil billionaire creating a compound to escape the inundation. And that can possibly be the way to your discovering that there is going to be an inundation. And perhaps there's a way to avert it or to protect people or, you know, develop your own monad. Or you could play a character who has this backstory that, you know, they have a monad and they're predicting the end of the world. And you know, 3/4 of their predictions are good. So that's just they're using a random roll method and sometimes failing to beat the difficulty.
I would say that if you're going to use the maps, the Scallion maps, I think those make a lovely parallel Earth. And it can be a place where, you know, the sort of superhero Flash Gordon-y type people descend from. Or it can be an Earth that was, you know, wrecked by Cthulhu or by whoever as a example and a warning for your characters to avoid. And is it bleeding into our Earth, Tlon Ukbar style, or is it maybe just trying to replace us because we're uncataclysmed and they want to have California back? Who can say? But I think that that makes it a great, it can be a travel destination, it can be an enemy, it can be a source of treasure and story. And you've already got a cool map of it, which is the most important thing.
Well, on that note, I think our work here is done for yet another exciting episode. And we'll be back with more of the similar a mere week from today. Stuff having once again been talked about, it's time to thank our sponsors.
Atlas Games.
Pelgrane Press.
Arc Dream.
Flagbearer Games.
Dork Tower.
And Pro Fantasy Software.
Music, as always, is by James Temple.
Audio editing by Rob Borges.
Support our Patreon at patreon.com/KenAndRobin.
Protect this podcast from electronic floods by joining such backers as
Kevin J. Maroney,
Dan Simons,
Gray St. Quentin,
Hector Trelane,
and Jay Moore.
Wear this show or drink it from a mug with Ken and Robin merch at kenrobin.dashery.com.
Celebrate your joy of missing out with our latest design, Chomo.
On X, he's at Kenneth Height.
And on Blue Sky, he's robindlaws.bisky.social.
See you next time when, once again, we will talk about stuff.